Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung Shulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we are recording on Saturday, January 10th, 11th, something like that.
January 11th, Erin.
Yeah, 11th. Which means that for me, it is the 11th day of dry January. So I'm going to ask you ladies what you're drinking in the hopes that it's more interesting than anything I've had to drink this month.
I am drinking a cup of coffee that has vanilla vodka in it.
Did you microwave that coffee?
Yep.
Yeah.
It was made today, but it's microwaved.
Oh, well, that's good. That's a start.
I'm drinking fancy Swiss Miss hot chocolate with a little bit of whiskey in it. But it's fancy. It's dark Swiss Miss chocolate. Hot chocolate.
Nice.
I highly recommend it.
So one of my many experiments during dry January is to add bitters just to like various mm-hmm. kinds of fizzy water, which does make them more interesting and delicious.
It definitely does.
I have to say. So I am drinking some sort of Italian soda, like a lime mint Italian soda with Peychaud bitters. It's delicious. It's would be better with gin, but
yep,
here we are. I hope my liver thanks me in the future.
I mean, I feel like Donald Trump owes you a personal apology, Erin.
I mean, I have done both the Iran crisis and Megxit without drinking a thing. And it's just, you know, quite something.
That's intense.
That said, I did Christmas and New Year's while drinking all of the things. And so here we are. So pay me now, pay me later. We are going to do something a little different on this episode. We are a few days into an ongoing crisis with Iran. Many of you have asked for an emergency podcast, and as you know, we don't do that. So what we thought we'd do is just devote this episode to all the many different angles of the Iranian crisis, and hopefully that provides enough fodder for us to have points of departure for future episodes when we kind of get back to regular programming. Well, let's switch gears now and welcome our guest, Dr. Suzanne Maloney. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. Great to be here.
Thanks. We're so glad you could join us. I'm sure you've been doing a million media hits this week. You are a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and we're very glad that you could join us and try to walk through a lot of different parts of the Iran complications and how we got here and what's next and all of that jazz. So before we get into that, though, we have some bombshell questions. Who is your fictional or literary hero?
Yeah, these are tough questions. But the latest book I've been reading, not because my kid had to read it for school or anything, is The Penelopeid by Margaret Atwood, which is a retelling of part of the Odyssey through the eyes of Penelope.
Oh, interesting.
And it's just fantastic. And it's such a great, I mean, I wouldn't say she's the most amazing literary heroine of all times, but what's amazing about the book is how seeing this part of the tale through her perspective is so incredibly refreshing. And you get this incredibly empowering sense of someone who is a side character in the actual original. So that's my pick.
Have you read Circe?
I have not. That's next on my pile here.
Excellent. Yeah, it was really good. And a similar side character, you'll cross paths with Odysseus there for a while, but there's plenty of others for you to enjoy. So that's great. What do you follow like a sport that is not a sport?
Well, here I'm giving myself away or giving someone in my household away, because what I end up following like a sport that's not a sport is the online grading system for the Montgomery County Public School System.
That's a great answer.
Slightly ashamed of that.
Well, you know, we all have our crosses to bear, I suppose.
If you could pitch Netflix on a show or a series, what would it be?
It would definitely be a version of The Office, but set in a Washington think tank, filled with intrigue and bureaucracy.
I love this.
Yeah, I think that's a good example of a show that we think would be hilarious and that no one would actually watch.
No, I think The E-Ring was very popular.
There'd be like 20 of us who watched it religiously.
Yeah, and we would also all just be the screenwriters, though, so it would be very confusing.
Advisors. Funnier versions of us would be screenwriters.
Oh, funnier versions of us. Okay, yeah, that might work. All right, last question, my favorite question. Suzanne, what is your favorite algorithm?
Okay, here, I have to admit, I'm 100% stumped. I am Generation X and I am non-tech and I have no good answer to this whatsoever.
Oh, man. Well, I have to say the Spotify algorithm remains fascinating. Radha, what was yours? You had a really good one.
My current algorithm, and I have so many questions for the fine folks at Waze, is why? Why can you not give me new routes around the 101 when there are accidents on it? Waze, get with the program, people.
All right. Well, we'll work on finding some new algorithms for you, Suzanne. I think there's certainly something out there that will catch your fancy. But now we have to turn toward more serious matters. And I guess we should note that we are recording on Saturday, January 11th. And the current state of play up till now is that we are about 10 days, not quite 10 days out from the strike against Qasem Soleimani in Iraq by the United States. We are a few days out from Iranian retaliation, missile strikes against an Iraqi base housing American soldiers in Anbar province in Iraq, and also a few days out from the crash of a Ukrainian airliner, which the Iranians have now accepted responsibility for shooting down with an anti-aircraft missile. Most of the major muscle pieces that have been moving, there could be many more things happen before this podcast actually comes out, but Suzanne, I wonder if you could help us maybe take a step back, help some of our listeners who aren't in the weeds in Washington, you know, understand kind of how we got to here, you know, what's gone on over the last year or so that's brought us to this point and set the stage for us a little bit.
Sure, I'll give it a shot. You know, this is really the culmination of a policy that the Trump administration has been pursuing with considerable consistency since coming into office. I mean, obviously, it's been a bit of a roller coaster in terms of personnel, in terms of different style of leadership from this administration. But on Iran, they seem to have a playbook and they've stuck to it. They started out almost immediately with the travel ban that targeted Iranians in larger numbers than any other population that was banned from entry to the United States. They immediately took aim at the nuclear deal through a series of measures that came to a head in May of 2018 when President Trump walked away from that deal, began reimposing intense sanctions on Iran. He ratcheted up that pressure in May of 2019 by trying to drive Iran's oil exports and revenues to zero. And at that point, the Iranians really flipped the script and began ratcheting up pressure of their own, both through incremental steps to walk away from the nuclear deal and through a series of relatively mostly small-scale calibrated attacks on infrastructure around the region, including some rocket attacks on American installations in Iraq. That brought us to late December and an attack that appeared to violate what the Trump administration had set as a quote-unquote red line. The killing of an American had been articulated by Secretary of State Pompeo as something that might draw American military reprisals. And several days after that happened, we found ourselves in a situation in which the U.S. Embassy in the Green Zone was nearly breached by protesters that appeared to be mobilized by Iranian-backed Shia militias. And the next night, there was this strike, which, of course, has brought us to where we are today.
In the spirit of sort of providing some context here, when we're looking at this and trying to understand how Iran is responding, what are their objectives, both sort of generally and then in particular with respect to this most recent strike and sort of associated escalation?
At base, what they need is an end to the siege that they're facing as a result of the Trump maximum pressure strategy. Their economy has been sent into a tailspin by these sanctions. They've managed better than I think some within the Trump administration and some observers might have anticipated. But ultimately, they can't go on forever without with the current levels of economic pressure, which have driven down their oil exports by at least 3/4. They're not able to conduct business as usual in terms of accessing the international financial system. Most of the revenues that they have are being held in escrow overseas. And so they need some end to the siege. And what they've calculated is the only way to do that is to try to create some kind of diplomatic pressure on the administration from other parties, including the other parties to the nuclear deal, that might persuade Trump to concede, or at least to be a little bit more flexible than he's demonstrated so far.
And so if we want to think about, I think one of the things that's sometimes hard for foreign policy analysts to remember is that other countries also have domestic politics or have competing constituencies that different leadership is trying to please. Since we're going to talk about the American process and some of the JCPOA pieces here a little bit later in the show, but can you maybe help us understand some of the Iranian domestic politics and what pressures they're feeling, both in terms, as you note, the economic pressures the people are facing? There were quite a few protests around Iran last year, but more broadly, kind of, you know, how the, you know, regime is, you know, who it's trying to appease, who it's, what it's trying to do to, in order to stay in power, and how it thinks about those problems.
Well, that's the staying in power part is really what it's all about for the Iranian leadership. Iran has pretty interesting politics internally. It's a competitive regime. It was created after a revolution in which there wasn't a lot of consensus about what should come next. And so they've really been fighting about exactly what that should be in terms of what types of economic policies, what types of domestic policies they should implement ever since. But ultimately, they're all sort of in it together. And so there's a certain degree of consensus, even as they squabble on different aspects of internal politics. And they recognize that there really is no alternative in terms of conceding to the United States. The Trump administration has essentially asked to put 12 demands on the table that are pretty much everything that the Islamic Republic does in the region and at home, give it all up, and then we can see the end of these sanctions. It's just not conceivable for this leadership. And, you know, what they're dealing with on the home front is a population of 80 million, most of whom were born after the revolution. They're politically entitled in the sense that they go to the polls all the time in elections that aren't free and fair, but at least they understand what it means to have political voice. They're engaged and they're highly educated, highly interconnected with the world, and really, really frustrated because there are no good jobs, because they recognize that their government is spending an awful lot of money and effort overseas in a variety of conflicts that have not really brought much for the Iranian people. And so they've seen protests as recently as November all around the country that were repressed pretty viciously. And even today, in the aftermath of the news about the plane crash and the responsibility on the part of the Revolutionary Guard, people have again come to the streets critical of the Iranian leadership.
So let me pull together a couple threads on things you said, which you mentioned the sort of need for external diplomatic pressure on the Trump administration and sort of Iran having internal economic conditions. So a lot of the discussion there has been driven by the sanctions and really the threat of secondary sanctions for external anyone who trades with the Iranians. How do we want to think about where we're at with the Iran deal generally, with how the administration's approach to this strike and this escalation vice the Iranian approach and internal pressure, sort of where does that leave us in terms of a potential future Iran deal and potential future nuclear Iran sort of in one direction or the other?
Yeah, there is, I think, a direct connection for the Trump administration between the approach to the nuclear deal and the strike last week that killed Qasem Soleimani, the most significant military commander within the country. And that is this presumption on the part of the Trump administration, which really reflects the Republican critique of the deal that's existed ever since it was completed in 2015. And that went something like this: that the deal itself was insufficient. It really wasn't going to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon. It was only going to defer that day slightly. And during the time of that deferral, the Iranians, in fact, would have access to greater resources and that they would be able to expand their power and influence around the region much more forcefully as a result of the nuclear deal. And their other problem, one of the other many problems with the nuclear deal from the Republican side, was this perception that because we were, in fact, so concerned about ensuring the deal's survival, we were far less inclined to push back on Iran in other arenas, particularly across the region. And so I think for the Trump administration, the theory of the case has been get rid of the deal because it really wasn't a solution to that problem, and push back really hard against everything that Iran is doing in the region, particularly in ways that play to our own advantage, which is an advantage of overwhelming conventional military superiority. The Iranians have a lot of proxies, they've got a lot of assets, but we've got the U.S. military, and they understand that, and they don't want to tangle with that.
One of the things that I'm wondering is we've been, you know, the other dynamic that's been playing out this last week or so has been the U.S.-Iraqi relationship, and will Iraq push U.S. troops out? Kind of how do we manage that relationship going forward? Because, of course, we conducted an airstrike, you know, on Iraqi soil. The Iranians conducted a missile strike on Iraqi soil. And I'm wondering if you could help us understand a little bit of how the Iran-Iraq relationship kind of plays into this. Obviously, we know that there are proxy forces in Iraq that have some ties to Iran, and presumably that's what Soleimani was in Iraq to deal with. But more broadly, kind of, you know, how does, you know, since the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 and the rise of a Shia government in Iraq, how has that relationship changed from probably when you first started looking at this region?
Yeah, it's kind of a remarkable thing because it was such a foregone conclusion for anyone who understood the dynamics of the region or the players even back then. I was in the private sector in 2003, and we built scenarios to try to figure out exactly how this might play out. And, you know, exactly what we anticipated came to bear almost immediately and has been the primary factor in the U.S. efforts to try to stabilize Iraq ever since 2003, which is the Iranians were incredibly well positioned to move in. They had, you know, close allies among the parties who were advantageously positioned to take senior offices in the aftermath, in the power vacuum that was created by the U.S. invasion. They understood the terrain. They understood the political dynamics and political culture, despite the fact that obviously they'd had their own long breach with Saddam Hussein and hostilities with Iraq. And that just has been, I think, an element of the environment in Iraq that we've never really been able to overcome. The fact that the adversarial U.S.-Iranian relationship corrupts and complicates everything that we're trying to do within Iraq and plays out in such a negative way for the one sort of primary foreign policy objective for now three administrations has been to have some kind of a successful termination of U.S. military involvement there.
Kind of echoing a question earlier about the parallels in the Iranian domestic politics along with U.S. domestic politics, something that we've tracked here in the U.S. obviously is who drove the decision to strike Soleimani and how was the decision process made? I'm curious on the Iranian side, are you tracking that, but also Iranian domestic audience, are they likewise following in Iran how Soleimani's death is going to play out in terms of who's up, who's down, in terms of decision making, and also how the internal debates are driving how the response is going to go? In other words, obviously there are factions in Iran that are going to be driving a more hardline response versus one that is more restrained. And is the Iranian audience as obsessed with that kind of back and forth as we are in our own domestic politics?
Well, what's interesting is particularly today with the announcement on the part of the Iranian leadership that it was the Revolutionary Guard that shot down a civilian airliner in the heat of the moment as they launched the ballistic missile barrage at al-Assad and Erbil in Iraq, causing the deaths of 176 people, mostly Iranians, mostly incredibly successful, well-educated Iranians who had found or were finding lives outside the country. There's this immense anger that has kind of bubbled to the surface, along with grief, but there are protests playing out right now in a number of Iranian cities. And the critique is aimed directly at the one person who's responsible for everything in Iran, and that's the supreme leader. And you know, there's been a lot of anti-regime protests, but what's so interesting here is that the supreme leader publicly identified himself with the reprisal attacks on U.S. forces in Iraq. He was reported that night to have been in the operations center. This is kind of consistent with the very personal role he played during going to the front during the long war with Iraq. So he's the one that people are targeting. And even the Revolutionary Guard commander who came out and took responsibility for what they say was a mistake, they thought it was a cruise missile incoming, has essentially sort of indicated that it wasn't entirely all their fault, because he took responsibility and said, we did ask for a shutdown of civilian air traffic during the attack, but we were told that was rejected. And so they really are, I think, it's fascinating to see this sort of public accountability pressure focused on the one man who it should be focused on, Ali Khamenei.
Last question before we get you off here, Suzanne, is what do you think will happen next? Do you have any expectations of further retaliation on either side, ideas on what the Iraqis might be up to, or are we all just waiting and watching?
I think this has been a really interesting and unpredictable crisis, and I think it would be, you know, impossible to give a really well-informed prediction of where things are going next. That said, I believe that, presuming things remain stable in Iran, they will look for more opportunities to retaliate against American interests and partners across the region and across the world. That's kind of core to their security doctrine, that they really believe that if they don't push back hard, that the United States will read that as weakness and exact even more pressure on them. So I think we're in for probably a long and drawn out and probably pretty ugly conflict between the two sides.
Well, on that happy note, we will let you go. Thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate all of your insights and hope that our listeners do too.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
So instead of moving into keeping up foreign relations or White House mayhem, and don't worry, we're going to have plenty of White House mayhem to discuss. Can we have maybe a handful of questions that we can try to walk through to unpack the U.S. side of this equation, ladies? How does that sound?
Only a handful?
Only a handful. Yeah, I mean,
I have a lot of questions, and, you know, we'll do our best with the answers. I'm sure it'll be great.
I have a lot of questions, and obviously, as often happens, this is a pretty fast-moving story, and we're not going to be capturing all of the day-to-day swirl, especially as this comes out in a few days. So this will serve as hopefully a useful reminder to folks. Obviously, one of the first questions about the strike against Qasem Soleimani in general was this strike legal? And I guess a follow-up question, a related question is, does that matter to anyone? I actually think that the answer to the administration is kind of the latter. Like, that's like a academic question to many. But assuming we care, do we feel like this strike was legal? Radha, you dealt with this a lot.
So I'm not a lawyer.
We're not lawyers. Imagine, no one's a lawyer.
I imagine if this were a different administration, there would have been 18,000 meetings by lawyers to figure out under which domestic and legal authorities such a thing might operate, such a strike might be legal. I think given the sort of history of Soleimani and that he's, you know, a pretty bad dude, and given the claims that there may have been threat streams, there probably is a case to be made under the president's Article 2 authorities and under international law. Now, that's all dependent on the underlying evidence and the case being made. And I think the issue here, at least to my mind, the issue is less whether it's legal and more whether the administration really cared enough to marshal the evidence to make a case that it is legal or not. That is, did they put together a packet that had information on, like, here's a threat stream, here's the standards by which we judge things being sufficiently imminent, threats being sufficiently credible, et cetera. In past administrations, that certainly would be the approach. It's not clear to me that it was here. And I think that piece is probably more concerning, especially because that same evidence is what you'd want to know as to whether the risk of blowback from such a strike would be worth it.
This administration has every potential of making the case that this strike was legal. they have not done so. And the fact that they have not done so is interesting in and of itself, whether that is incompetence or they don't care or they don't have the evidence. It's really difficult for us to judge. I think some interesting points in that background is, like, they have obviously held classified briefings on the Hill that to give further evidence than what we know right now. There's a ton that's leaked in the press, but it's difficult to tell on the outside how much is actually accurate or not. But the fact that the president has said things in public rallies about the possible imminent threat stream that is different than what was said in classified briefings suggests to me that they don't have their shit together in some form or another. And whether it is the incompetence, lack of evidence, or don't care, don't know, but it is looking like it is possible that they don't have evidence consistent with what, when Radha and I were in government, we would have considered an imminent threat stream that had been decisively analyzed both by the security community, but also by the intelligence and legal community to say that, yes, this makes sense within that framework.
And one other just bit on that, which is the threat streams they're talking about, which are embassy threat streams, are particularly concerning because the other things that should go along with them, in particular notifications to the embassies and notification to AMSETs in those countries, didn't happen or don't appear
exactly
to have happened. And so if those were credible threat streams that underlied this, there's a lot of concern about the process and safety of Americans or whether the administration is being disingenuous in the credibility of threat streams. And neither of those are great options.
Yeah, but like as I think the three of us have talked about before, the legality of what the president does in terms of his commander-in-chief foreign policy powers only matters so much as Congress actually gives a shit about doing anything about it. Like, and I hate to say that. It matters in terms of precedent. I apologize to my legal friends who I just gave a heart attack to. But it's not as though there's a court of law that is going to come down and say you did wrong. Courts are really, really reluctant to weigh in on the president's foreign policy power. So they have done so in the past. But there's not a referee that's going to come out and say you did this wrong. Congress is the one that has that leverage to be able to say either you did this wrong from a legal perspective and we are going to put constraints on you further, or to kind of politically censure him in some way purely by getting it out in the ecosystem that this was done erroneously in some form.
And certainly this has been compared to some of the high value strikes from the Obama administration and even ones from earlier in this administration against al-Baghdadi, obviously the bin Laden attack in the Obama administration. And I guess, you know, we're going to discuss kind of the effectiveness of this in just a second. But, you know, at a minimum level, you know, there is from an American domestic political perspective, the authorization of the use of military force that was passed following 9/11 does cover al-Qaeda related entities, which would cover bin Laden and Baghdadi, for example. I think it's a much different question. And I'm surprised it's obviously gotten some discussion on Twitter and other places. But, you know, Qasem Soleimani was a major general in the Iranian military. I mean, he was a state actor, and we attacked him not in Iran, but in a third state. And so that whole part of it to me just strikes me as like, holy crap, you know, how is this not a bigger point of concern? And I think also probably speaks to a little bit of how members of this administration view their Iraqi partners, which is not particularly partner-like.
I'm amazed that I am saying this. I so rarely say anything nice about Jim Webb, but Jim Webb's op-ed in the Washington Post that came out today, Saturday, is actually quite good on this point in making some interesting comparisons to Vietnam.
So, Radha, you brought up the point about, you know, kind of what this is meant to accomplish. And I have to say, there's both a tactical and a strategic element to this. My first question, you know, when the initial rollout of the administration's justification came, they were saying that there were imminent threats to American interests, and presumably now we think it might maybe were these embassies. And so that demanded that Qasem Soleimani be targeted and killed quite quickly. It remains totally unclear to me how killing a major general of the Revolutionary Guard Corps stops these sorts of attacks. On the other hand, I guess we haven't seen the attacks, so what do I know? But this kind of gets to a broader question. I mean, this is high-value targeting and counter-network operations of like the highest order. Again, talking about a state actor, even though one that operates a little bit more networked fashion than most militaries. The IRGC runs militias and other kinds of, you know, non-state actor groups kind of around the world. I don't know, maybe we should like take a step back and think about if we had, you know, some neutral platonic ideal of an administration, we received threats, you know, a threat stream against, you know, particular air bases or embassies in a region, and we knew that there was a high profile state actor who was involved in coordinating them through his personal ties or whatever. Would you guys counsel such a strike? Do we think that's an effective course of action?
I'll answer your question with many questions. I think
great.
I think the answer really depends on what you think will happen after the strike. And I don't mean that flippantly. I mean, you know, if you think that Soleimani was really a key actor in planning these operations and that removing him from the battlefield has the direct impact to the ability of those forces to operationally continue to plan and execute on those threat streams, then that is a significant thing that you want to sort of take seriously as a justification for the strike in and above and beyond his role more broadly in a sort of adversarial state's military, right? So there's that specific threat stream that the benefit from removing him, if assuming that's the case, then has to be balanced against the fact that you're removing a state actor from an adversarial state. And like, what does that mean for the like state v state conflict? That's not something typically we think about in these contexts. You think right. about it a little bit, maybe with Al-Qaeda in the old days, with things like Taliban and Pakistani governments. But generally, we didn't worry really about state actions. And the one time we really cared, we thought about it much, relates to the bin Laden raid, where we basically accepted the high likelihood that American forces would be, you know, not allowed and any sort of cooperation with Pakistan would be frozen. And we viewed it as worth it given bin Laden's role in 9/11. And I think most people are comfortable with that. I don't know that Soleimani rises to that level. I think a case can be made that he does. But I think the question on the escalatory pathway here is really in some senses second order to whether removing him would, in a world where you believe these threat streams, would removing him stop the threat streams? And I think what has been missing thus far from the case is that that is relevant. I don't disagree that he's a bad guy, like, and I don't particularly have a lot of objections to removing bad guys from the battlefield. But if you're going to make the case that it's an imminent threat and you need to remove the bad guy because of that, you need to sort of make that internal link to that last part. And I haven't seen much on that yet.
God, yeah, my kingdom for an internal link. Sorry, Lauren, go ahead.
No, I think I was going to say something similar to Rada on that of, is Soleimani vital to the threats that we are worried about, like that his removal is going to have an impact on that? And if you remove him, are you going to like put us into an escalatory spiral that we should be really concerned about? And those two questions do not, to the degree that the administration thought about those, how they thought about them is not evident, because you would assume that they would have, if they really cared about those two factors, that they would have either put out more evidence about it or prepared to mitigate all of the escalatory actions that might have come afterward. And unless they're really, really, really good at hiding those, it's difficult for us to take seriously that they did that analysis. And, you know, maybe we're all on the outside and they just hate people like us Monday morning quarterbacking things that we are not seeing on a day-to-day basis. But it's not evident from people who studied these things and worked on them for a long periods of time.
Of particular note, like the airspace question, sort of giving your partner, I mean, Aaron alluded to this at the beginning, but not giving them even a heads up that the strike was coming. I'm not saying like a huge amount of advance notice. Maybe you don't want to do that for operational security reasons. But I think the lack of notification to European partners and to the Iraqis themselves is very both telling and concerning as a way to conduct an operation of this nature with these kind of risks for serious regional escalation.
I'm curious though, Rada, how, I know that we all, we've had the HVT debate on here before, but if you could kind of sum up again, what is in particular in the Obama administration, what was the justification and the argument for why taking out leaders in violent extremist movements was effective and necessary to be able to do. Because I think that people can make a could make a compelling case linking these two, but have not necessarily done so quite yet.
That's right. So just very quickly, there are two pieces to this. One is you want the groups to be continuing and imminent threats. Those were the standard by which you sort of justified your group that you're targeting and the individual within that group. Once you had that, then what you wanted to demonstrate was that the group's operational capability would be degraded by removing the senior leader. So that is, the next best person is worse than the best person they have there. And at least in the short term, for the groups we were talking about, that is true. Now, I say that that way because there are two big differences here that are worth thinking about. One is the groups like Al-Qaeda and later ISIS and Al-Qaeda affiliates like AQAP in Yemen, they had a fixed set of people, at least in the near term, that could take over operational planning, especially the kind of operations that would lead to strategic impacts, like against U.S. forces or in Europe. It's very different when you're dealing with a state actor and a state military, right? Which in theory is much larger and has a bigger bench.
And is institutionalized, right? Has a number of other levers, does not suffer from the rebels' dilemma or any of these other limiting factors that clandestine terrorist organizations suffer from.
Correct. And the second is that the ability for those groups to escalate isn't great, right? And there's only one dimension they do it, which is planning more attacks, which already is the dimension you're fighting on. That's really different when you're thinking about state actors who might escalate in a range of dimensions, including but not limited to other types of military actions, economic actions, and like pursuit of nuclear weapons. So there's just a very different sort of calculus that has to go into the idea of removing a leader in the context of state actors, which, to be clear, are very much operating proxy forces that operate like non-state actors. Like, I don't want to sugarcoat, like, Soleimani is not operating in a
standard. He is not a good guy.
He's not a good guy, and he's not operating just standard military forces. He's also operating a vast network of forces that are conducting sort of asymmetric warfare. So, you know, it's a complicated case, and I don't want to get too far down that, but it is different.
Radha is talking with her hands so much right now. I can't even imagine what the mic sounds are going to be like when Trey edits this audio.
You're welcome, Trey.
It's amazing.
We love you, Trey.
So I have two questions, and we can try to tackle these separately because they're both deeply relevant, but they're kind of down different paths. One is, what does this mean for whatever is left of the JCPOA, right? The Iran nuclear deal. And the second is, what does it mean for whatever it is that is left of our relationship, our, the U.S. relationship with Iraq? Radha, do you have, you worked on the JCPOA itself, but were certainly involved at DOE at the time. Do you have a sense of kind of, there were some initial actions by Iran, which some people characterize as the deal being dead, but others saying, no, it's just the last thing they can do without killing it.
Yeah. So Iran has actually been very strategic in how they're violating the deal, which is they've made it clear it's fascinating. It's like super interesting just as a statement in incentives and strategic behavior. But so what they're basically doing is deviating from a number of the caps that relate to sort of enrichment and construction of certain things that allow future enrichment, sort of to signal that they will have the capability to pursue a nuclear program without actually pursuing the nuclear program itself. And that's relevant because, and actually there's a great piece in the Post today about this, the Europeans really still want to try to salvage the deal. And the Iranians want to do that in two dimensions. One, I think they want to be part of this sort of international discussion. But two, if they can get a deal and basically get all of the folks who are worried about U.S. secondary sanctions to move away from dollar-denominated trade and have some other trade so that they can live inside a separate deal ecosystem, that's great for Iran because it significantly undercuts the U.S. maximum pressure campaign, which is largely based on pretty crippling sanctions, some of which the administration just increased as part of this escalation cycle. So I think there's a really strong incentive for the Iranians to signal that they need a deal to not pursue nuclear weapons without totally blowing it up so that people feel like they're so far gone, there's no point in trying to engage them. And they've been walking that line very finely. I'll also note the Europeans have been walking that line, expressing some serious frustration with this administration's approach to Iran and concern about the lack of notification and sort of lack of U.S. good faith action in the context of this specific escalation. So I think the deal is not dead. How likely it is to play out, I'm not sure.
But the Europeans have also struggled to set up some sort of special purpose vehicle that would allow them to move around the U.S. sanctions and the secondary sanctions and all of that. So they
Correct.
Would like something different, but they're still stuck in this world.
Yeah, but that's a time and effort question.
Fair. So that leaves us with Iraq, who just is getting completely screwed in this process, as best I can tell. We talked about this a little bit last year. You know, there were, of course, ongoing protests against the Iraqi government, largely led by Shia groups in Iraq through a good portion of last year. And those were kind of generational, you know, focused on, you know, younger people, very frustrated with the corruption of the regime, frustrated in some ways with the Iranian presence with the regime, their influence and trying to demand a more modern, accountable, transparent government. You know, fast forward to today, and there's remains a lot of frustration. But the Iraqi parliament took a vote last week. It was non-binding. On the one hand, it was unanimously in favor of asking the Americans to leave. On the other hand, all the Sunni and Kurdish parties abstained. So that's not the most influential, you know, sort of piece there. And then, of course, we got into this totally weird process foul back and forth on the letters notifying the Iraqi government that we were planning to leave or we weren't. I mean, some major was having a very, very no good, very bad day on the ground in Baghdad. But it strikes me that, I mean, you know, there was a lot of effort put into the relationship with the Iraqis. And whether it was lip service, and you could certainly make the argument that there was lip service, but there was a lot of effort that went into the lip service of, we are not occupying Iraq. We have Iraqi partners. The Iraqis had to give approval for a significant amount of military operations at one point. The U.S., of course, left in 2011. They're invited back in 2014 for counter-ISIS operations. And now it's totally unclear to me if we're staying. We still have suspended ISIS operations. We actually aren't doing anything counter-ISIS right now. And I think Trump would still like to leave, but now he's like, well, not if you insist, which is a very strange position to be in, but also threatened sanctions and threatened to remove access to Iranian hard currency at the Federal Reserve Bank in New York. So it's like bottomed out U.S.-Iraqi relationship, you know, kind of overnight as well, which I guess I probably would not have seen as being the obvious outcome here.
Guys, I'm not going to lie. I'm not sure the U.S.-Iraqi relationship is the healthiest one around.
Yeah, fair.
It's not a model for healthy relationships.
Yeah.
That's all
I mean, I think as one friend of a friend described it, the commentary from Pompeo about how you don't really want us to leave, you need me, is the exact sort of commentary of an abusive husband. So, you know, this is not where we really want to be here.
You alluded to this earlier, Aaron, just like the sovereignty violation of attacking another government from within inside Iraq is just so wildly offensive to that relationship, particularly if they did not notify them in any way, and is going to play out as a tension there for a long period of time. The thing that just continues to strike me is the way that the Soleimani strike just did everything possible to shatter what the ostensible Trump strategy in the Middle East was. So they agreed that they had a strategy in terms of like counter ISIS, maximum pressure on Iran, kind of sort of stability in Iraq. I mean, like, I'm just taking their word for it that these are the things that they cared about. None of those things are healthier now than they were before the strike. And they do not appear to be taking steps to repair any of those at this point in time, though again, behind closed doors, who knows what's going on. But Pompeo's words, Esper's words, none of them are kind of drifting in the direction of like, okay, we need to like work on this, guys, because at minimum, they should care about their counter-ISIS strategy. But it all kind of makes me aware. I think we were joking about this before at one point. It was all of this some like very strange, bizarre strategy to just get us out of Iraq altogether, because that seems like a very real possibility over the next several months that could play out, and could play out in a way that puts U.S. forces at risk with the speed with which they may be asked to withdraw.
Do you think, Lauren, that this would have been better if there was a better process to review this strike? Like, do you think that fundamentally, if what you wanted to do was strike Iran, that a process would have made this better? Or was this a shit show sort of waiting to happen? And
so this is something that I think certainly I struggle with, and I know other folks who've kind of served in like kind of technocratic capacities have struggled with in this government, that you look at the actions of the Trump administration, no matter how much you hate them, and think, I could have done them better. And this strikes me over and over again, that in terms of a rollout plan and notifying allies and mitigating risk against U.S. interests and embassies and so forth, and having our European allies both prepared and ready to shore us up, all of those things might have been possible and may have made this exact course of action more palatable, if not more advancing our interests. I think all of that would have been a huge amount of work just to mitigate all of the bad effects that are going to come out of this one decision that President Trump made. But it was possible, and the U.S. government does things like that all the time, and is that not that bad at it when you manage to ask them to do so. But we've heard now at least four different stories about how the concept of striking Soleimani actually managed to get on the president's desk. None of them are probably the exact story, but none of them really reflect any sort of process in any way, just more impassioned advocacy or the Goldilocks method of putting forward two extreme options and one regular option, or the intelligence community suggesting options, which is weird unto itself. They all speak to me, as we wrote about in the Washington Post, a really, really, really broken process that is now going to get the United States in trouble. Like, it strikes me over and over again, that the President Trump has the ability to kind of kill people whenever he wants. And when you put it that way, it's like, wow, that's a lot. That's a lot to freak out about.
Yeah, I'm not sure that a better process gets you anything without a better principle. I mean, just at the end of the day, like, he's the person who sets the final outcome and gets to, you know, spin the wheel and make a policy choice. And I don't really know, like, yes, I guess you could say, well, good morning, boys and girls. We've decided today to assassinate Qasem Soleimani. How would you like to roughly mitigate the complete and utter shit show that's going to create, right? And we could have a better call list.
Aaron, there's a TikTok for that.
There is. I mean, I guess I would divide it into maybe,
but
into
it's
three
still a bad
like,
idea. The whole point it's is a bad it's idea. Still like, a bad idea.
That I think the President of the United States, even when he makes bad decisions and he knows he's going to make a bad decision, owes it to the American people to think really hard about making that bad decision. Like, and that's kind of ridiculous, but I feel like he does owe us that. So there's the process going into it in terms of how he decides it. Does he actually listen to anyone who knows what they're talking about? And then there's the process of actually doing it and like making sure that you've mitigated risk, notified allies, done the actual TikTok. And then, like, now we're at the point of like, okay, so what happens next? Do you have a team of people thinking through all possible eventualities of both how can we be taking advantage of some of the chaos that we have created? Because we did, so let's at least think about it. And also, how do we, like, you know, think through, like, Iran holds a years-long grudge, guys. Like, this is not over today. This will be over in months, years, in terms of how they respond to the U.S. government. Are we preparing for any of the possible responses and making sure our allies are prepared as well?
Yeah, so that gets to what's next.
Yeah, and I just adding on to that, I think, for example, this airliner discussion that's sort of unfolding as we record here with the Iranian Aerospace Corps, I think, taking full and in some senses broad culpability for it, is taking it in the context of saying they thought it was an all out war with America and they didn't know what was going on. So it was a human miscalculation, but like miscalculations happen in war, roughly. There's this, I don't know if it's unanticipated or totally anticipated and they don't care, consequence of Iran seeming like the responsible actor here. They talked about taking a proportionate response and cited Article 51. Meanwhile, Trump is tweeting about bombing cultural sites. They're taking full responsibility for shooting an airliner and talking about sort of the lack of information and clarity coming out of the United States. They've signaled willingness to renegotiate independently with the Europeans on an Iran deal, right, on a nuclear deal. So I feel like there's a loss of U.S. strategic leadership and vision that comes from this type of action, which is not in full candor, something I typically worry about. but it seems so palpable here just in terms of the U.S. seeming like a disorganized and sort of erratic actor and Iran seeming like the grown up, right? And taking measured action, taking responsibility, right? Like you could just imagine the situation in reverse and that feels weird. I'm not saying they are actually doing that, but I'm saying they are creating the public appearance of that. And that is a strange sort of after effect that we will see play out.
Well, and I think that they're deliberately cultivating that because I think they're playing to the Europeans. And then the downing of the airliner, though, has created a very strange domestic problem for them. And so whatever shoring up the regime might have gotten from the assassination of Soleimani, now they have to manage this crisis domestically with a very different set of prerogatives. Meanwhile, I mean, I think the current administration doesn't have to worry at all about Americans thinking that Iran, it looks like a responsible party. You know, that's unlikely to be something that's a shared belief amongst the president's base. And he doesn't care about what the Europeans really think in this instance, even though he should, even though his Secretary of State should, certainly his Secretary of Defense and the combatant commander should. I mean, I just can't even imagine what's going on in Tampa right now. I mean, literally, can you imagine what's going on in Tampa? It's got to be
crazy. You mean after the dance party?
They have all of the Margarita machines running and they are just like printing out op orders like no one's business. It's like con op. It gets crazy pants.
You are seeing pushback and concern about the president, you know, willy-nilly starting wars with Iran. And I do think Trump's base cares about a war in the Middle East and sort of willy-nilly spending money and effort and military time on these endless wars, which is something he's actually been pretty on message about not doing. And this is very contrary to that.
Yeah. I mean, we see Tucker Carlson, Matt Gaetz, like these are not normally individuals that I have a lot in common with in terms of their own commentary, but they are saying not crazy things at this moment about basically holding the president accountable for sticking to what he says he wants in the Middle East. But there are crazier things that have happened, I guess, than having Tucker Carlson agree with me.
And I think that we'll still see some retaliation that stays below some particular conventional threshold. Although, obviously, we've seen direct attacks on, you know, U.S. military equipment and significant Saudi installations. So it's not like the Iranians were really keeping a great lid on things previously. But I think that they'll be, you know, as Suzanne said, we're not done with this yet. So we will be sure to be covering this in various future installations, instantiations of keeping up foreign relations, White House mayhem, etc. Meanwhile, we have one pop culture topic we'd like to discuss. The pop culture topic to end all pop culture topics.
Megxit.
This is so Megxit. Great.
This is so great.
It's so
I don't think that most people would guess that like the three women who love talking guns and bombs and bourbon and national security are also huge fans of like, what do we follow that's a sport that's not a sport? Like the British royal family. Like it's incredible.
It's
even though I treat them like
too,
celebrities.
We all do it.
It's incredible. It is actually one of the few things that we all super duper follow. So this week, Meghan and Harry.
I think we should be really clear that the three of us are so supportive of Harry and Meghan right
so
now.
So supportive.
100%.
Like, I get it. There are people out there that are like judging. You're wrong. You're extremely wrong. And we are correct in all of our assessment.
And I also really appreciate that they won. I just want to make clear some things up for people. They didn't surprise the queen with them.
No.
They told them she was going to do it. And then she asked them not to. And they were like, actually, we're going to do it. We were giving you a heads up. So I think she was more disappointed than surprised. And I think she shouldn't be because it was the right decision. And two, I love that Meghan just flew back right afterwards to be with her kid and was just like, yeah, you guys do you. I'm out. Like,
by the way,
that
is like a hugely supportive spouse situation. Like, I know Aaron doesn't totally agree on this, but when you get married, you deal with your family shit.
That's right.
You do not make your spouse deal with it. You deal with your family stuff, and your spouse can stay out of that, even if it's relevant to your spouse. Your spouse is a bystander in these conversations.
I mean, we should acknowledge that everyone should obviously take marriage advice from me on account of my zero marriages. So it's definitely true. But I mean... The whole thing is fascinating. I have sort of two reactions overall to this. One, this is just pure Diana trauma to my mind. And Harry is like, I am not freaking doing this to another generation. Two, I sort of wonder if Harry's like, look, we're kind of glorified celebrities anyway. I'm getting out while the getting's good. Grandma's not going to be around that much longer. This monarchy's toast once she dies. Like, we're going to set up shop and live large in Canada and be all set up with all of our trademarks and social influencing before, you know, the Kents show up. So, I mean, it's incredible. I, you know, as we said before, though, I do hope that Harry and Wills can
make up a little bit at some point, because it does seem that they're on a bit of a break.
I feel like continuous institutionally supported racist media commentary deserves a like, hey, if you're going to be racist, I'm going to make money off this business. So I'm going to get my influencer accounts and trademarks, and you write snarky things about me, and I'm going to make the monies, right? Like,
I mean, to be fair, they make a lot of money off institutionalized racism in the British monarchy. Like, just in case anyone was wondering.
I mean, I think that's where a lot of the money came from.
So, I mean, those Cornish estates, you know, are.
But I don't just mean the monarchy, right? I mean, like, I think there have been a number of good articles on the press coverage of,
absolutely.
Of Meghan and just. But frankly, when you read it all together, you're like, wow, you guys are really not very nice.
Speaking of press covers, guys, like, as we all know, but our listeners may not know, Nicole Cliff came back on Twitter this week.
Yes.
Not only to address this, she came back for another purpose. However, it was a perfect timing because her commentary has been lit and you should absolutely follow her.
We do love Nicole Cliff. Okay. That's it for us today. I think we're coming in at a pretty long episode here, but I think worth the analytic effort on all of our parts. We'll be back with the Maniversary episode, I believe, when next we hear from folks, and then to regular programming after that. So with that, we bid you adieu.